Hello, horror fans. Welcome back to Selling the Scream, a show about horror movies brought to you by one horror nerd and one horror noob. I'm Jed Donaldson, the aforementioned noob, leaving us with our nerd. And I guess today we're going to give him a nickname that's kind of appropriate given the movie that we're watching today. It's Josh Kuhn. How you doing, Josh? Actually, I hate that. As soon as it came out of my mouth, I hated it.
Yeah, no, that's a... You know, that's like somebody that has like two K's in their name, and you just, I'm on the lookout for that third K. I do appreciate though that unlike any other time we've ever done the show, you picked a nickname that has to do with the movie. So.
Right. Yeah. No, I figured I'd follow suit.
I'm doing well. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. And that's partially because it's not just you and I talking about this movie today. We've got a repeat guest. One of our all-stars is back today. It's Mr. Jason Duff. How you doing, Jason?
Surprise, everyone. I'm back.
I know you said we shouldn't.
Number five. And I was doing the math, and I've now been on about 8% of the Sell on the Scream show. So I'm starting to catch up with Jed.
You're getting there.
Yeah. Jed, what percentage have you done?
It's hard to say because while you may think that you hear me on every episode, I'm really only here for maybe a third of them.
Yeah, I put together a soundboard pretty early on, like just a lot of like sighs and...
Somehow he managed to get the sound of my eyes rolling, which is, I mean, bravo.
You just need two buttons. I'll buy the scream, and I don't buy the scream.
And air horns.
We go for that morning zoo atmosphere here.
Well, how have you been, Jason? It's been a long time, man.
You know, I've been great. Yeah, it's really just, it's life in between podcast episodes, really. So I'm trying to think about what's happened since the last one. I guess the big thing is.
Is that real living?
it's a prison. So thank you for letting me out of prison to come and enjoy this podcast. And we're heading to Disney World next week. So that'll be fun. My wife is now a Disney vacation planner.
I might have to bug you because we love going to Disney and we only get to go like every couple years or so. My wife has really been kind of testing the waters for another trip. So if you got a little juice for me, that'd be wonderful.
Absolutely. I mean, this is the ad portion of the podcast, but magicbymandy.com. She's a Disney vacation planner. And the nice thing is she doesn't charge anything. Disney pays her for everything. So she can leverage their VIP lines and help you out. And so if you love your family, want to go to Disney, again, that's magicbymandy.com.
Nice.
Fantastic. We'd love to get those plugs in early.
Does she offer packages for people that want to go Disney ironically?
that's a new consumer group she needs to work through.
that's great, man. I knew we had to get you back because your wheelhouse traditionally with us, you are my friend who Jed was the one who needed to be sold on horror. You firmly just do not like the stuff for the most part.
Do not like. Right? That's right.
So yeah. In general. So,
I mean, you should take my spot on this podcast then.
I'd be just a tougher sell. Like for me, like this is really at the fifth episode of Selling the Suspense. I'm buying the suspense.
We just got to find that little intersection where horror and its suspense overlap.
Okay.
That's right. Yeah. I don't want to use, I always sleep with at least three nightlights. I don't want to use all six.
Got it. So if one extra one goes on because you saw, something where somebody held a knife upside down.
Oh, yeah.
No. You're verging on that territory just talking about it, Josh.
I do appreciate you every once in a while picking a movie that isn't pure horror, and I get a chance to talk to you guys again. And if you don't mind, I also got a few letters from fans. I just give you guys a little temperature of the room.
It's weird that they send them to you. We specifically tell them where to send them.
directly to me, so I can only imagine how many haven't, you know, made it to me. But, you know, one is, you know, Dear Jason, I'm a real person and an on-again, off-again listener of Selling the Scream, but I never miss when you're on the show, which I thought was really touching. I appreciated him or her spend the time to write that. And then the second one was, Dear Jason, like the previous person, I'm also a huge fan. And know whenever you're on the show, it's going to be a laugh riot. So,
also a real person?
That's what they said. So, I mean, I got to take them at the word. So I just wanted to thank you guys on behalf of the fans for inviting me back.
Yeah, I mean, that's what we do it for.
Do we have these documents? Can you send a screenshot?
I don't even need, I read them, so it's the same as a screenshot.
That's as good as a screenshot.
I'll just save you an email.
Yeah.
Save those e-trees.
we're gonna dive on in here, but I do want to just kind of make a note. You might hear just a weird timbre in my voice, and I don't have the vid. I just have a very nasty cold. It's not gone away in the past week. So if you hear some ahems in the background, or my laugh is more Motley like.
I have noticed that as I get older, when I get sick, something hangs on long after the rest of the symptoms have stopped.
Yeah. I feel like people did not like adequately prepare me for like how terrible getting old is.
You just take whatever they say and just go, you don't know.
I feel like nobody told me when I was younger, like when I something fell down by the couch and I just like dove down and grabbed it and stood right back up. Like nobody grabbed my shoulders and said, treasure that. Like you will need an exit plan to do that from now on.
I don't know. But at the same time, you know, think like the cast of Cheers when it started, they were all in their mid 30s. So they were all younger than us. But if you look at, you know, the pilot episodes, see Norm and Cliff and like they all look so much older than us. So like we're doing better than the cast of Cheers. And then you know, Golden Girls, they're all in the mid 50s, which is the same age as, you know, Jennifer Aniston and our very dear J-Lo. So I think a lot of ways we're also doing like I didn't expect to be this, you know, good or healthy when I was, you know, 42.
Okay. Well, do we talk about the unrealistic body expectations that Jason sets on this podcast?
Only when he's on.
Yeah, actually, I had a letter about that, but I'm not going to read it.
Yeah, well, I mean, you can only eat up so much of our airtime with congratulatory letters from your fans.
But, you know, Josh, I do appreciate you saying that you have a cough, because at any time during the show, Jed and I can also cough very obnoxiously. And our dear listeners will just assume it's you.
Ooh.
So we get a free pass. I'm gonna throw in some deep coughs here.
I did not consider that angle. We could really just tear his reputation up.
The perfect crime.
And it's not too late to get a sponsorship from Dayquil.
I could bring in my family members and really get them in here too. It doesn't just have to be me coughing.
Yes. Yeah, wow. I'm about to swallow a whole bunch of water down the wrong pipe, so get ready for this. But again,
that's
Josh
bold.
Is going to be blamed.
Could we call that a cacophony? y'all need to start. Jed, you need to start the show, or I'm going to keep doing this.
I thought we did. All right, this is a show about horror movies. God, no more. Typically. Specifically ones that Josh has put together in a list to, like, in an effort to turn me into a fan. It's working, sort of.
We did it.
Mission accomplished.
As you might have surmised from our thriller conversation just a moment ago, we got a thriller this time. We also have an anime. We have our first animated feature on the show. We're doing Perfect Blue. 1997,
which I want to say is one that I remember seeing on the shelf at Blockbuster, but I don't think I ever had any real impulse to pick it up and watch it back then.
which, like, you watched a lot of, and I don't presume to know your current viewing habits outside of
Anti.
The view of this show, but
exclusively.
Well, I mean, we're kind of close in this one, right? Like,
there's some cartoon boobs, but whatever.
You're specific. You have specific tastes. Got it.
Very specific tastes developed over a long career.
But if I thought this would be a sale for you because your passion for anime series, I think is probably more than mine. You've watched more of those over the years.
That's true.
And it's also a movie about girl groups. And I figured, who else but Jason Duff to get on to talk about his favorite subject?
Josh, hit that mute button, buddy.
But yeah, we're doing a, you know, I am going to just go ahead and get ahead of, is this horror? Do we want to have that conversation up front? Is that, other than Jason is on the show?
I mean, it's almost kind of a spoiler alert. We have to.
I mean, it's on Shudder. It's streaming exclusively on Shudder right now. So, that's.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's a case closed.
I mean, back to the whole Blockbuster piece, though. Like, would this be in the horror section? Like, I don't think so. I think it'd be in the foreign section.
It's just a foreign film.
Yeah, it's a foreign film.
Yeah. They're speaking some made-up moon language.
Yeah, by the way, Josh, like, you really pull one over. I mean, it's basically a book report because, like, ladies and gentlemen, like, this movie is not even in English. So I read the whole movie. So this is my very first book report podcast.
Got it. Paying no attention to the visuals. You had to keep your eyes tightly focused.
You can't look at the pictures while you're reading the words, Josh.
Listen, Josh, you know I'm a slow reader and sound things out. We don't need to air it out in front of everyone. So it's basically just a book.
But this is our first animated film. It's a film of Satoshi Kon. I'm guessing, Jason, you probably have not seen any other Satoshi Kon films. Jed, have you seen his other movies? Are like Paprika, Tokyo Godfathers, the other one? Boy, just drawing an absolute blank now. But I don't know if you've seen either of those.
I have not seen anything else from him. He is, however, a name that I am familiar with. In that I have heard that almost everything he does is excellent.
Yeah, it's he got started working under the dude who he did like some manga series and worked on anime in various roles, but wasn't like a director or a creator. Worked under the dude who did Akira.
Okay.
And then got offered a directing gig on an OVA for JoJo's Bizarre Adventure. There's been a couple series on that one.
That's a fun show.
Jason, I'm guessing you aren't familiar with the concept of the OVA. It's a fairly culturally specific.
I was getting ready to Google it. Can you save me the Google?
An egg? It's kind of like a low rent. It's like a direct-to-video movie in the U.S. It's like they'll kind of target a very specific niche audience with it, they don't spend a lot of money on it, and they don't expect a lot of money or like cultural impact out of it. It's the movies you'd find like a dime a dozen on Amazon.
Got it.
They decided they wanted to make an OVA of a mildly popular horror novel, Perfect Blue, and the studio Madhouse liked that one well enough and had a modest budget and they brought him on. And just his ideas and kind of ambition and scope for it, by the time like it was getting finished, they're like, oh, this is like a movie. Like, we need to put this in theaters and have people watch it. Not kind of an expected thing. So I ended up like playing at a bunch of film festivals and like played at the Fantasia Festival and won their Best Foreign Feature award there. Satoshi Kon, much like you, Jason, not a fan of horror. He has said that if if he wasn't hired on to do this, like, he wouldn't have played in this space.
The plot thickens.
But he does really like this kind of intersection of, like, sense and memory and how we forge personality. Like, a lot of his other movies have to do with that. So he kind of went to the writer, and it like, when we talked about One Cut of the Dead, I think in Japan there's, like, a real different relationship between, like, movie makers and, like, the authors that they base movies on. Because I feel like here it's just like, well, don't like that, fuck you, and, like, just the guy's cut out. Like,
I think that's one of several things we can say is different between here and there. I think we can all agree.
Yes. But in this one, he went to the author, and the author's like, okay, here's the things you have to keep. It has to be about a pop idol. It has to be a horror story, and she has to be stalked by somebody. But, like, all this, like, show within a show, actor stuff, and dream sequences, and, like, blurring of the lines, that's all Satoshi Kon. That's he worked with another screenwriter, but it was all kind of through him. So.
I bet we're going to talk about is this horror several times throughout this episode. I don't know that I think it is, but I also don't know that I think it isn't.
The Mendoza line is called in. Okay, we'll have to go to the judges, go to the panel. I guess it's whether Jason likes it or not. Is that the is that going to be the line that we just
is there any other definition?
Yeah, if Jason likes it, not horror. That's
I'll know when I see it.
Yeah. That's. But I think we forget if we were mentioning this up top, but or if we said it on the show proper, but it's. The subject matter and the genre is really unusual for anime, especially at the time. Like, there had been horror-themed stuff, but the horror-themed stuff had been more, like, Castlevania-ish, or, like, Vampire Hunter D, or, like, very gothic and in line with other, like, over-the-top type anime. And this is, like, there's some very fantastical sequences, but it's a grounded psychological thriller that basically takes place in the real world. Like,
right. This is not, you know, a lot of people, when they think of anime, it's a lot of screaming and charging your power levels. This is not that. Very little power level involved in this show.
People learning forbidden acting techniques.
Right. Yeah. They had to find the old master. I think it is. I don't want to say strange, because I don't want to, like, kind of cut down what can and can't be covered in a particular medium. Like, I think anime can do a lot more than just, like, Dragon Ball Z shit.
Yeah.
But I think it is unusual, and it stands out because it is not, like, the vast majority of what's being produced in that sphere.
And even, like, specifically, like, what makes it overseas. Like, this was released in several different countries, and, like, I think you talking about there being such a broad range of animation styles in anime and stuff, like, a lot of the stuff that plays to a Western market is, like, the stuff based on Shonen Jump fighting series, like,
right,
kind of aimed at teenagers, and
right. I mean, because, I mean, here in the, well, I guess the West, for lack of a better term, cartoons are still generally considered to be kid stuff.
Yeah.
It's changing slowly, but that is generally where the thrust of the marketing and the content of the animated programs are aimed at.
Yeah. What this really has more in common with is the Italian giallo movies, because a lot of those movies first of all had, like, these, like, kind of bloody and graphic deaths, because there are a few, especially one in particular, like, it kind of extended brutal killing scene in this movie.
Yeah.
But they also play a lot with like the construction of identity and this memory and sense and victims not recalling where they were when something happened or missing some piece of their memory or only hearing something and listening to hear that thing again. That's like a lot of like giallo tropes is.
Yeah.
So every time...
you said that Satoshi Kon was not a big, like not a fan of horror like at all. Did he intend to make it like this? What's like, was it intentionally made as like a giallo, like you said? Well, or is that just kind of coincidental?
I can't speak to whether he's like seen those or not. He didn't really say in like interviews, like if he was directly influenced by those movies. But I think what did happen is he had this premise that's kind of like a standard slack. Because the original novel, very bare bones. It's a pop idol who has a stalker trying to kill her. The things he's interested in are all this like heady extrasensory stuff, and he staples that on there. So I don't know if it was a coincidence that he kind of reinvented giallo accidentally,
or just like... the alchemy came out that way. He wasn't trying to make one, but he just the thing he made just happened to be that.
Yeah, I mean, I know for certain, like later on, like all that stuff was kind of out in the, because he kind of, this movie launched his career, and like he ended up like really influencing a lot of different folks. We can there's like Darren Aronofsky lifted stuff from this movie. Mm-hmm. And like for Black Swan and for Requiem for a Dream, and like Paprika is a lot like Inception. Like it's very pre-Inception. So yeah, I think just sort of that intersection, even if he's recreating it accidentally, I think he's doing it in a interesting and unique way. That's kind of unique. It's his. So
sure, yeah.
But yeah, are you all ready to dive on into this one?
Yeah, let's go. Let's do it.
Talking through it.
So we're here for.
We're already doing that.
Well, the movie deeper? Itself. We're kind of doing the background stuff. We'd start with the people involved and the some sort of story. Shows that I can access the internet and find things.
Important to let people know.
So did this fake out opening get either of you? Speaking of like things you normally see in anime, opening with the Powertrons fighting Kingberg.
When it came on, because I watched it on Shudder, and when I hit play, it just immediately went into this. Like there was no preamble or anything like that. I assumed that this was like in most other movies that you would watch streaming, you would have like something pop up beforehand, like an advertisement or something. I thought that this was just like a related film or something from the same studio that they were trying to advertise. So I wasn't quite sure what I was getting into it, because like I said, it just started real fast.
Is this where the eye rolling for you started, Jason? Is this where you like?
Nah, I'm still just in shock for having to read this movie.
I think it's kind of a neat thing that they do though, because it's like this very Power Ranger thing where like they're fighting against some villain, and then the camera kind of zooms back and you see that it's like a live stage show.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then people are just like bored by it, and like oh, it's nothing like the TV show, it's like a modest.
When I was watching it, what came to mind was like how strange it is and how different it is that like they do that sort of stuff over there, but we don't really do that stuff over here. But I mean, we do. It's just we don't really have it set up outside. It's it's for kids. It's like Disney stuff or whatever show is on tour, whatever show they're watching. They'll do it in like a auditorium or a theater or something, but we do this sort of stuff here.
Oh yeah, I went and saw the Ninja Turtles perform their Coming Out of Our Shells tour.
Oh shit, Brad.
I am well aware. I was the oldest child in attendance. Pretty cool.
How do you know that? Did they take a poll?
Well, there might have been like a very small older child there. There might have been like a really tiny 14-year-old or something.
I was 17.
But I think this is kind of like a neat thing to lead into, to sort of subvert expectations of what reality is going to be in this movie, where you're like, wait, what the fuck am I watching? And then it like zooms back and it's like, oh, it's like a modest stage show that for some reason is mostly attended by grown men.
But that is the next part coming up is a big difference between here and there is the idol culture.
Yes.
Like, we don't really have anything like that here.
This was made in the late 90s. I would argue we kind of did with, like, we didn't have, like, I feel like the strata that they have there of, like, kind of the people who are only the diehards know about, but all the diehards are, like, 25-year-old dudes.
Right. I'm not going to say that we don't have anything that kind of ticks some of the same boxes, but I will say, and this is, I'm not an expert, I will say that there is nothing that we do here that is like idols over there. There are, it's, you kind of think it's like, oh, it's a music group, right? So it's like pop music, but there are hundreds of them, and you may be a fan of one specific one in this group, but not the rest of them. And it's just, it is very weird and compartmentalized.
Yeah. And I think this is a movie that has some things to say about it as well. Like, it's, about how it's packaged and marketed and sort of what that means for the people performing it.
The closest thing you could really say is like stuff like Britney Spears, like those type of bands.
Yeah.
Right. But this is much more, there's a lot more trying to break in, and that lower level that don't really make it, there's like, it's like a, like little, like double A baseball.
Yeah.
Like the farm teams, the farm league.
And they, you still have your, almost,
yeah.
Yeah, you still have your people who are like, yeah, because this band Cham that the our main character Mima is in, like they have very dedicated fans, but they're not like, they're not selling a lot. They're performing after the Power Rangers.
Yeah. But you know, all this is to say that is why there's an older crowd here, is because they're following the idols. They don't give a shit about the Power Ranger show.
Yeah. Yeah. But still, like, you know, has that Spinal Tap, like, you know, the puppet show, also Spinal Tap feel to it. Like, like, it's not, you know, it's made very apparent in the movie that they, for as glamorous as it is, and as much like intricate choreography and stage work, and as much as like they have magazines of people talking about their comings and goings, it's not something that they're like getting rich off of.
She has a small apartment, and when they showed like the, like how well selling like one of the singles were, was like the 46th best selling single.
Yeah.
So, like, they didn't seem all that popular.
I'm sorry, Jason, where have you charted?
Well, listen, I like their music. I like my favorite line of any of the songs was, "This year, I'll not exert myself and dress casually."
You like it. I live it.
Speaking to both of us.
But this leads to, like, we get, like, this discussion among, like, all the fans about what's the comings and goings. And they think that Mima, one of the members of the group, is going to be her last show, which it turns out it's going to be. And you get the title drop as they come out, and it's the perfect blue with like no border on like parts of it. And I think a lot of the ideas in this movie are about like things that have borders dissolving,
bleeding into each other.
Yeah. And like, we even start strong here where it's her final show. And as the show is going on, there's incidents that unfold during the show. We are seeing like the aftermath edited into it as well, like her just coming home and after the show and shopping and like just going about her daily life and then flashing back to the show again,
right? Kind of setting up that like the conflict of identities that she's going through as the show goes on.
So we're introduced to her and her like bandmates. She's gonna be leaving her band. She's got a couple of managers. She's got Rumi and Tadakoro.
I think Tadakoro is like the actual agent, and Rumi's like an aging idol who is like kind of
there for the agency.
She's now, like the talent management portion of the agency.
Yeah. And then there's also a guy out in the crowd who's our stalker, Mr. Mimania.
That's right.
They
her Romeo.
they don't really try to hide the fact that this guy is the one that we're looking at.
Oh yeah. What y'all think about this character design? This
I mean, he would have to go through the airport security line like 5 times, no matter how many times he went through with no metal detector going off.
They would pat him down and say, "You got to go through again because I don't believe that we didn't find anything."
Yeah, we just really do not want you on a plane.
He does have like the so he's really tall. He's got long black hair. He's got these like eyes that are basically like black and flesh colored.
Yeah.
Really fucked up teeth. Does not talk very much, at least until like
kind of later on. He looks like he smells like wet cardboard.
But guys, that's on the outside. On the inside, a heart of gold.
Yeah.
Clearly. Real incel heart of gold on this guy. But like we're introduced to him doing like maybe one of the creepier things I can think of, like I've seen recently, is the when Mima's dancing on stage and he's like kneeling at an angle and looking up, holding his hand up so that she's dancing on the palm of his hand.
Right, but you don't think it's creepy when the kids in the hall crush your head, though.
Terrifying. That's like I was saving that for our 100th episode. That was the and the sequel, Bludgeon Your Face. But like we're seeing a lot of this backstage stuff too, where they're Mima is leaving this group. She's graduating. Just like, you know, today I graduate from Best Buy.
She's no longer a rookie idol. She's gonna be a rookie actress.
Yeah, she's gonna start her acting career.
They do more of the identity stuff here too, where it's the two like head agents arguing about whether or not she should continue being a singer or step up to be an actress, and a lot of pressure is being applied, and they don't really consult what she wants too much.
Rumi asks what she wants, but then she like kind of walks over. She's like, have we even considered what Mima wants? She came here to be a singer. It's like, okay, thanks for telling everyone what I want.
Yeah.
I do like the, does Mima strike you as the sort that would always have on like 24-hour news playing? That doesn't seem like a big character trait for me. Like she's a 21-year-old pop idol, like living.
Yeah, I mean... At the risk of sounding like dismissive, I wouldn't expect her to be in touch with the news cycle.
It is no more surprising than her having a fax machine.
I think that's just part of her job. That's how she gets offers and stuff. That's, you know,
singing during the day, faxing at night.
Exactly.
Hey man, I worked in a place that charged people for faxing, and we made a pretty penny off of that, because who has a fax machine?
Currently 21-year-old Mima.
A threatening fax, though. That's our second clock tower reference in our last two episodes. The coming to get you fax threat. The
fax. I mean, yeah, the fax wasn't the first threat she got, though. We got the letter that was given to her as she was leaving their performance, that she opens up and basically says, "I'm always watching Mima's room. And here's the link to my website."
Yes, and it's 1997, and so she hasn't gotten her AOL disk in the mail yet.
Right,
she doesn't know
in the infancy of the internet.
Yeah, but if she did have was more internet savvy, I'm sure she would have visited magicbymandy.com, your one-stop shop for all things.
Oh, I mean, no doubt. Yeah. That would be set as her homepage.
Yes.
Yeah, but she doesn't know what that is, so like they're also making like and the audience doesn't really know what it is yet. They just see this note that says, "I'm always watching Mima's room," and you just got this big open window shot of like Mima's like apartment room.
Yeah.
You know, talking on the phone and getting with her mom before she gets a threatening, heavy breathing phone call. That old classic.
I think there's one part about this movie that I think it misses on, is that she goes through a lot in the course of this movie, right?
Yeah.
But a lot of the things that are threatening or scary don't actually happen to her.
Yeah, they're kind of happening in her orbit.
Yeah, she doesn't really get directly threatened until like the very end of the movie, which I think I could have used a little more direct intimidation of our lead actress to kind of help set off kind of the journey into dreamland that she takes through the middle part of the movie here.
But I think a lot of that is like internalized pressure. There's like a lot of that where this stuff's all happening all like on around her, and it's like it's really more about her like figuring out who she is. And then once this stuff hits, it's like, oh shit, this is like really hitting. It's not just me like losing my fucking mind.
Yeah, like, I mean I can see that. We start off with, you know, we have the creepy letter and then the threatening facts, and then there's, I mean, not a really a whole lot that directly threatens her going on through the rest of the.
There's a lot of little creepy things that she does. She keeps seeing that guy.
Yeah.
And kind of realizing that she's seeing him like gradually. And she also she gets she figures out the website eventually and is able to like get on there and see that it's like very detailed. It's like first person accounts from her point of view, with her, like even stuff about her, like what brands of things she likes and why she does
what she stepped off the subway train with first.
Yeah. And I think I might agree with you that like that stuff, she's just sort of like, well, this seems bad. And then goes to her job the next day. Like,
yeah. I mean, I don't know. I'm not saying that it doesn't work or anything like that. I'm just saying for me, I would have expected there to be a little more direct interaction with our heroine.
A little more horror.
I think a lot of that stuff just comes later. It's a lot of build up in this one.
Yeah.
So Mima gets an acting job. It's just like a single line or like three scenes on this like a serialized television show called Double Bind.
Law and Order.
Basically.
Yeah, it's like a riff on, because they were very similar shows in Japan, and I think what Conan said about it is that he thought that all of the Japanese shows were basically just chasing whatever like big twist was in like a recent Hollywood movie.
Yeah.
Hence like the, you know, oh, he's like killing the women and skinning them and wearing them and you know, the a lot of multiple personality stuff, and it's all the stuff from, you know, Seven and these other thrillers of the time, Silence of the Lambs, and
yeah,
just getting recycled.
Nowadays it's all about some guy with a big glove trying to get five Infinity Stones.
that's yeah, just the real dead serious down to earth courtroom drama Law and Order, like. Like special guest star like Brad Dourif with the Mind Stone or something. my favorite, I think it's a bit that is the John Mulaney bit. I just don't want to repeat it verbatim, but just the Ice-T's role on the show, just to be like to be incredulous over the sex crimes that people do. You're telling me.
Yeah, he's a pedophile. This is going to happen a lot.
We're introduced to some of the people on the show. There's like the main actress who kind of pops up a little bit. And then there's like the writer and the producer of the show. Shibuya has the old, the writer has the old writer's secret of having no clue what the fuck's going on. Is that the actress is like, oh, tell me where this plot's going. Like, oh, I can't spoil it for you. And then they walk away. It's like, I don't know what I'm doing.
He literally went to go work on Lost.
The final season of Game of Thrones. But there's another direct threat here on this first day. She just has the one line, the who are you? And there's the exploding letter gag.
This, little, you know, prank.
That old Marx Brothers bit. The threatening exploding letter.
I mean, there is a little bit of a threat in here since it does end up tearing up her agent's hands.
Yeah, which he takes in real fucking good stride, by the way. Yeah. Like, don't even mention it again. I certainly won't.
Like, oh, it's just a prank. I'm not hurt that bad.
Yeah. Well, it says, like, the next one will be real.
Yeah.
And, you know, as this is going on and she's, like, they're realizing she's, like, not being featured in this show very much, her old band hits the charts. I love the swagger. The fucking, oh, we don't make any money, do we? Wacha! Throws down the magazine on the table. Just. I think you said like 40 something. I think they're like maybe 80 something. Like it's. But yeah, they're still like, what?
It's not really at all like a big number for them to hit. It's just they've never done it before.
Yeah, yeah, and it's, I mean, it's at least getting, like, your foot in the door. I think something we hadn't mentioned up top, there's the, there was the, at the show, the ruffians who wanted to disrupt everything. These Jimbo and Kearney, motherfuckers trying to throw garbage boys at the stage.
Yeah.
But there's like a little subtle thing here where, again, like it's sort of a threat that she doesn't really notice, is that she's walking into the office and
the newspaper clipping on the elevator.
Yeah, yeah. That the leader of that group had been hospitalized in a hit and run, or killed in a hit and run.
I think it said he's in critical condition after a hit and run.
Yeah. Which the Mr. Me Mania had gotten into weird Michael Myers fight at the show with
him. they just walk up to them, tell them no, and then get punched a bunch.
but then just still stop the next garbage throw with your bloody face.
Yeah.
So good news though for Mima, she's getting a bigger role on the show. Bad news, it involves a rape scene. Did you guys bring your kids in to watch this movie? I probably should have, like,
warned. Well, yeah, I mean, I heard we were watching cartoons, and
reading's important, so yeah, I had a Harper in there too.
you brought it in like, see, it's gonna be like Jodie, what's her name? But you know, Mima's kind of trying to figure out like where she belongs, if she's an actor or not, and she's like committed to trying this out, so she decides she's gonna do it, and it leaves her kind of affected. And then on the way home, we get this,
like, I mean, it's a pretty intense scene.
Oh, it is. Yeah.
And they have to keep stopping and starting and stopping and starting, and
but there's like a little bit before it actually gets filmed where she's already starting to, like, this is where she's starting to see her pop idol self. She sees the reflection for the first time in like the advertisement, and I think this is like, even though it's a really grounded movie, I think a lot of these transitions, like, this is kind of why it's animated and why you do something like this animated,
because they do a lot of really cool stuff with reflections in this show.
Yeah, there's a lot like, or people caught on video, or people, you know, in a, either in a mirror or just reflected in like the glass of a vehicle that they're in, or like out their own window. Yeah, I agree with you. Did any of that stuff catch your eye, Jason? Did you were you able to look up from the reading long enough?
It's all I noticed.
You saw only the reflections, only a reversed world.
Anything that is very artistic and cerebral, yeah, you better believe I caught that.
But I think that's a, you know, it gets overused in horror and thrillers quite a bit, but I think there's a lot of power there, especially when you're talking about like fundamentally about construction of identity, because that's how you experience yourself visually. You can't see your own face. So it's as that starts to alter, I think it does. It's a compelling, psychologically thrilling device, I would say.
No, I think a lot of this stuff works.
Yeah. Yeah, there's this is a lot of the stuff that like kind of gets cop for Black Swan too.
I mean, they do a good job of setting up the pressure that she's feeling about, you know, leaving her old identity behind and trying to start this new one. And is that what she wants, or does she want to kind of hang on? And who is she?
And also her old band is now like experiencing success and she's struggling. Like,
yeah,
it's a lot of that stuff going into this, and just sort of
she's having to do things she never would have had to do if she just stayed an idol.
But the this reflection is like also claiming to be like the real Mima, and she's seeing like this Mima's room,
yeah,
stuff as well. And she's kind of like increasingly going on there and seeing this stuff about like not wanting to do the show, and like it's pretty crazy. And then it leads to the filming of that rape scene. Like you were saying, like it's the way that it's done is like they kind of cut it. They start out big where you're seeing like the whole production, you're seeing everybody work on it, but then you're seeing basically the monitor and you're seeing like what's going to air. And yeah, that is, you know, watching the show within a movie, but there's kind of no distinction until we have these moments where they like break or cut or pause to do something.
I mean, it just kind of goes along with the rest of the movie with the like the blurred lines and what's real and what's not.
Yeah, that always kills me when they're like it's in the middle of it and they stop it, and it's that the guy who's like on top of her. She's like, it's the scene where her character is at a strip club and like the patrons just go crazy and like knock the manager off the stage and like pin her down, and they're doing a bad thing. They like pause it like right in the middle, and she's like, you know, it's she's giving the best performance she can, and the guy who's on top of her is just like, I'm really sorry about this. Like this very awkward.
Yeah.
Like
it's super relatable. Like I can't imagine having to film something like that, having to enact that.
Yeah. And like as they're doing it, they're showing like the director's room where like all the people working on the show are like super excited. And like you see her team, that Tadakoro is kind of like, is this going to be okay? And Rumi's like smoking her cigarette down to the end and then leaves in tears.
Yeah.
This ends up airing, and, you know, Mimania takes it very well. He's, we do see his apartment for the first time here.
Yeah.
Like all covered in pictures of Mima on the wall. It's kind of like Jason's basement with Wilford Brimley, just, pictures on the ceiling. Goes on there, turns out the lights, turns on the black light, and the black light Wilford Brimley's talked to him.
The mustache tickles.
The diabetes. But this is where we're starting to kind of also get the people who were involved in her acting career start getting murdered. Our first death coming up. What y'all think of this, the writer's death scene, Shibuya, who pulls into the parking garage? That great, huh?
I'm going to try to edit in some crickets there.
I really like this. I like the, he pulls in and his, parking space has been, his name has been covered up with the double bind, like, you know, in kidnapper font.
Right. And it looks like maybe some sort of blood splatter or paint or something.
Yeah. And he starts to hear the Cham song, the one that plays probably the most throughout the movie, the da 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 da, your little angel, that one. Yeah. And it's getting like louder, and did this scene work for you at all? It's the, he's trying to get to the elevator opens, and it's the boom box with the blown out speakers playing it, and the next scene's just floor five and opens up, and we get our first bloody mess eyeless body here.
I kind of expected it to happen. And I don't know, this may be, you know, just a function of me having seen movies that have setups like this for people dying since then. Like, maybe this was more surprising at the time. But, I mean, it seemed pretty by the numbers.
Yeah, a lot of boom boxes.
No, I mean, not like the specific things that happen, but just like the setup and the execution. You're in a parking garage by yourself and you're hearing a sound, you know, are you alone? Are you not alone? But, you know, there's the audience knows that something's out there.
Yeah, we're aware that we're watching a movie.
Yeah.
I find it, for a movie like full of misdirects and stuff, maybe it's not the best one in it, but I do appreciate kind of the effort of just making the boombox. Is the boombox the killer? Is that the
as far as misdirect go, I think the second kill, the photographer,
yeah,
is a much better misdirect.
Got it. The we do cut to like the city at night, and then they cut to like the police siren, but the police siren's like on a child's push toy as he's like walking around. Like,
yeah.
But yeah, the she hears about this death. She's still going, and it you know, again, it's like somebody sort of tangentially related to her in her life. Like, she's met this dude and he writes on the show she's on, but like,
yeah,
she doesn't know that connection, that that's why he died. But she gets the, she passes in the car, the other version of her, the serves you right.
Yeah, this is I think this is the part where we see a lot more kind of bleed over in terms of like her real life and her life on the show, like, yeah, pieces of what's happening on her actual show are kind of imitating or maybe like in her head sort of seeming, yeah, like the same things that are happening in actual real life.
Yeah, she's Mima's just method, baby. She's a real Jared Leto. Which, like, speaking of Jared Leto, the upcoming bathtub scream. That's another Darren Aronofsky lift for Requiem for a Dream. The after the fallout from the next thing that she does, she tries going on like a photo tour or like an interview tour, wearing like a lot of like kicky little scarves before she does a photo session with a photographer famous for getting ladies to take their clothes off. I feel like this is like really also an artifact of the time too, that late 90s, early, yeah, 2000s. Like, I remember a lot of Rolling Stone just like, here's Britney and she's almost naked. Like, here's our candid photographs of Christina Aguilera.
I feel like it still happens. It just, you're right that it was much more like in your face back then.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's still, I mean, there's always going to be people using like sex to sell, but it's, I feel like it was more of like a kind of cultural expectation and just sort of, mm-hmm, like how we treated women celebrities in particular.
Yeah. Like in the movie, they actually just kind of say, oh, they kind of brush it off as, you know, just kind of the cost of doing business.
Yeah, that's but there's kind of a confusing sequence here where she's promising that she's going to sing at a concert at the same time that this photo shoot's going on. And there's kind of like the dream version of her that Mr. Mimania sees. So he's kind of seeing into his delusion a little bit, where he's like projecting her there while she's having this photo shoot happen, so that when he sees her magazine come out with candid full bush nudes, which boy, like I didn't think in the just regular newsstand, it's just like, well, here's a
I mean, different cultures. You've heard of like Page Six girls, right?
Yeah, I guess.
And by the way, I didn't see any of this because I was reading the subtitles.
I was only masturbating to the subtitles.
It was a really nice sans serif font.
But there's like, this is where we start to get like a lot of the blurring, like you were talking about, like the a lot of dream fake outs where she's shooting and then like going to go meet her former bandmates, and like the dream version of her is like in with them, and she like chases out after it through the studio.
It's almost like a Groundhog Day kind of section here, where she keeps, it's just waking up in the bed and the same sort of stuff is happening over and over again.
Yeah, and like what is dream that is happening and what is real is really unclear, because we're also getting, for as much like fantastical stuff or like people disappearing or reappearing as stuff as we're seeing, we're also getting dialogue from other characters, like Rumi telling her like, I haven't seen you for a long time, and because it's a replication of the day before, and she's just like, no, I was here yesterday, dog. Like,
yeah, because they're like, they're sitting in the same spots, eating the same cake.
Yeah. But there's a lot of I think kind of interesting like dialogue and kind of moments here. Just like, there's real like brief cool little moments where she's like chasing after herself through the studio before like the first dream fake out, and she collapses down the stairs, and she comes up and she looks in the mirror, and it's like there's that moment where she doesn't know if the mirror, the reflection she's looking at is actually her own reflection or the like the dream self.
Right. Before
the dream self like pops up behind her and moves away.
Yeah, running away. Yeah.
Yeah. More like echoing stuff too, with like the she sees the stalker, Mr. McMania, driving a bus toward her that's gonna hit her on the street, which we'll get to the ending of this movie. And like she at this whole time she's going onto the website and seeing that like the person who's writing the website as her is like saying that it's not the Mima you're seeing in like the newspaper and on TV is not really her, and that she needs help. She needs somebody to like stop the fake Mima. Help me.
Yeah.
Like, but like she's starting to dissociate further. It's just these scenes where she's like, and her character in the show is like now getting revealed to be the killer in the show as well. So there's a lot of
bleed over. Like part of this that we're kind of, I mean, we did mention it, like the Mimi's Room website being so full of information that there's no reason someone else besides her would know, like really specific, really personal, really exact information that it's really kind of setting her off as like, is this me?
Yeah, she's saying maybe she's more like me than myself.
Yeah.
And like looking at the website to figure out where she had been yesterday.
Right.
Yeah, a lot of this stuff in it, like it's real easy to lose the thread here, I feel like. And it's I think in a lesser movie, there would be like a lot more questions at the end of this movie about just what the fuck happened. And I think it's this, real credit.
This middle section is real floaty.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's real floaty, but like, I do feel like it kind of holds up. Like it's all thematically of a piece,
I think I agree.
Yeah. And it's really just kind of her losing her shit as she, as all this is happening around her and she doesn't know who she is anymore.
Right.
So you mentioned the next kill, that photographer who took those racy pictures. He orders the wrong big body pizza.
I love how like that is one of the words, like the words in English is pizza, overeating. That needs to be in English. Big boy, big body pizza.
This apparently is a reference to like a musician that he likes was in a, put out an album called Big Body. So yeah, it's definitely a line that maybe plays a little differently here versus there. But he gets fucked up with this ice pick. This is a pretty prolonged and brutal scene there. It's like he bends down to get the pizza because the pizza person drops it and the pizza person's identity is obscured.
Right.
Gets stabbed in the eye with the ice pick, stumbles down the hall, closes himself off in his room, gets stabbed through the glass door.
Yeah.
Reaches for the phone, gets stabbed through the hand into the phone. And this is kind of also where we
you are missing the headline though, Josh, though. The pizza was delivered within 30 minutes.
And yeah, don't bury the lead.
When they called to complain to the big body pizza about it. Hey, the pizza got there. Like what our driver does afterwards. It's not on our time. But Mima, we're realizing that Mima is like kind of experiencing this third person and seeing herself. And it's a kind of another dream fake out, or is it? Where she's revealed to be the pizza person stabbing him to death. And they're flashing all the scenes of like her reputation getting ruined. Cause she's getting like the website and like her alternate ego, her pop star ego that she keeps seeing, this dream self is like body shaming her for doing what she's done and like ruining her image. And now she's a tarnished woman, a filthy, filthy woman.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's a pretty, I think that's an ending you could have gone with. I think you could have gone with the, she's doing it in a dissociative state that leads into the TV show.
I was going to say, they explicitly do that in the show.
They film that like as Mima actually finds the evidence. She finds that shopping bag of apparently where she'd been shopping with the bloody clothes in it. And then the episode of the show that's being filmed, it's a confession with where she's basically herself in the show and she's getting diagnosed as being somebody who thinks they're a pop idol turned actress who's actually a murderer. But then like the tape rewinds.
Right. Well, like when they started with that, I thought that they were really like, that was what they were really actually going with. Like, and all the rest of this was just in her head, like filling in the blanks for herself. But she really was this person doing these things the whole time. But then they go through the same scene several times, slightly changing the dialogue, and it kind of comes into focus a little more.
Yeah, and like the plot of the show that she's on is that her sister was murdered by whatever the killer was, and you find out that she has been the killer the whole time, and that she like took over her sister's identity. And it's, again, like I think kind of a little bit of a goof on a lot of that as a like an answer to the and I'll find out if you think the actual ending to this falls in that same camp, but of sort of the thriller ending of the thriller ending of the time. But she gets the applause. She gets the, you know, everybody cheers. That's a wrap on the show.
Yeah.
And again, like a lot of the echoes and stuff in here, there's this Mr. Mimania is sent after her. And there's this right in that same studio where she had her filmed rape attempts to rape and kill her.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's stating that, of course, she's not the real Mima because the real Mima emails him every day. And
the real Mima would have recognized him.
Yes. You don't even know I'm Mr. Mimania. we got a little back and forth struggle here, and then before, you know, at kind of the last moment, she finds a utility belt with a hammer in it and just cracks him in the side of the head with it. Which, like, I do appreciate the long, like, did that work? Is that stopping this guy?
Oh, yeah, this was definitely, like, the most traditional slasher horror film moment where, you know, she hits the guy and, like, you think, well, that could feasibly kill someone, but given the type of movie this is, it probably didn't. I'm waiting for him to get back up.
Yeah, he's and falls down. There's a lot. It's funny because, like, I feel like I'm talking through a lot of plot in this movie. I probably also should mention this movie's like an hour and 20 minutes long. It packs a lot in. It's very.
How long have we been recording this podcast, by the way? Have we gone over an hour and 20 minutes?
We're almost there.
We're getting there. Yeah. But this, you're also kind of led to believe that this guy has been, like, maybe the culprit. If she's not the killer,
right,
this is the killer, and she's been projecting it onto him. But
no, you're explicitly meant to believe that this is the guy who's doing all this stuff. And yeah, right up until the part where you see her killing the photographer, I didn't really have a question about that.
Poor Mr. Tadakoro, her manager, makes the mistake of telling Rumi that he got Mima, you know, a new gig after this because she did so well. But it's a racy video, so what are you gonna do? That's the kind of actor she is now.
Yeah, he said there's a couple sketchy parts, but, you know, it's,
whatever.
What are you gonna do? This like, looking back after having seen the movie, like, all the way through the end, you know, you have Rumi just, like, her expression, she has a smile on her face the whole time. It doesn't change. Which, given how she reacts to some of the things she's, Mima, I can't say her name right,
yeah,
that she's had to do throughout the rest of the movie, her not reacting to that whatsoever is unusual.
Yeah, I think they, I mean, you know, spoiler, this whole goddamn podcast is spoilers, but the, it's not out of the blue that Rumi ends up being our killer. There definitely are things, like, she is the most vocal about, like, no, Mima needs to be a pop star, or, like, if she's acting, right, she needs to try it and not ruin her reputation so she can get back to being a pop star.
Yeah.
Because after she defeats Mr. Mania, Rumi takes her back to her place. She passes out in the car. There's a cool transition here. She's passing out, and
I didn't know what was happening until Rumi says something like, "I'm taking you back to Mima's
room." Yeah. And when she gets there, she wakes up in her own room, but it's her own room from, like, when she left Cham. It's still got her Cham poster up. Her fish are still alive that had died off. We don't know if those were killed, by the way, or if she was just mentally not able to take care of them.
Yeah.
But there's the living fish there. And I really love how Rumi's field here, where she's like, she's wearing the costume, but Mima's also having her delusions. So Mima's.
Yes. The back and forth between seeing Mima and Rumi as the same person, like, whether it be what you actually see or seeing a reflection showing the truth that Mima's not actually seeing in real life is really cool.
Yeah, like the first glimpse you get of it's the, like, just the mirror in the bedroom, where you can kind of see, like, the camera just starts dead center and you see the Mima there, and Rumi's like a larger character. My partner was up a little bit upset that it was like, oh, of course it's the fat girl. She's a bigger girl, and they, like, they go over to the mirror, and you kind of see that she's, like, straining this costume that she's in. It's Rumi.
But yeah, Mima's seeing, like, an exact reflection of herself in front of her, when the mirror's showing Rumi in costume where she's barely fitting into it.
Yeah, and they have this struggle, and, like, one of the first things that happens in the struggle is that Mima's pinned down by her reflection, and she reaches up and starts strangling her. And Rumi's face starts to pop out.
I loved this. She's strangling herself, and it morphs into Rumi while she's strangling.
Did any of this ending stuff work for you, Jason? Were you did you able to look up from the subtitles for long enough? To...
Yeah. You know, it was good. The thing that confused me a bit was in the middle of the movie when she saw images of herself as a pop star, and you thought that was all in her head, and all of a sudden you see someone dressed up as her. So I think back, that's the same person all along, but then, you know, from a body standpoint, that couldn't have been. So I was a bit confused for a second, but I thought it was good.
I had some questions about that as well. Like, I was willing to take it as her just being, you know, seeing, like, hallucinating her image as a pop star around. It was around the time when they had the show where she was going to be, you know, she's going to make her return to being a singer while she was having the racy pictures taken at the same time. I wonder if Rumi was actually out on that stage.
Well, I feel like if she was, like,
there would have been more.
Yeah, the there would have been something in the paper. Like, yeah. the managers would have been like,
Yeah, I mean, that's the only thing that really, like, I had that thought, and then I kind of dismissed it for that exact reason. Like, that probably would have made a bigger splash than.
or possibly that it could have been, and, like, maybe it was, like, the people in Cham just being like, oh, our manager, like, also used to be a pop idol. Some of you might remember, blah, blah, blah. Like,
yeah, like I think there's an argument that can be made that is what happened there.
Yeah.
But it's not super important.
Yeah, because, I mean, so much of this movie exists in Mima's head anyway. Like, I think a lot of these delusions are her delusions. And it's just, it kind of just maps onto.
Well, let's get back to this awesome chase. Well.
Yeah, yeah. So this, she gets chased out of her apartment, like, it falls off the apartment, like, crashes down onto the other building, is, like, fleeing away.
My favorite part of this is we're shown the fake Mima just kind of delicately floating and bouncing like a fairy, just on one toe, just tapping and just barely touching the ground, floating along after her. And you'll see, like, in the mirror, the windows of the buildings that are passing by, you'll see Rumi just, like, gasping and struggling to keep up as she's, like, sweating and mouth open, all disheveled, trying to chase her down.
Yeah, no, it's a pretty great sequence, and it ends up culminating. They, like, there's a dead end in an alley. Mima's been, you know, there's just, like, those movie stabbings that don't really, like, they don't hurt that much. She gets into an alley and is being, like, held against the wall and is about to be killed by Rumi, and does the Michael Myers move, pulls off her wig, pulls off her mask, and throws it through a window that got broken. And Rumi is just so desperate to get her identity back that she, like, dives to grab the wig, stomach first onto the broken glass.
Yeah.
Which, whoa.
Yeah, that made me wince.
But
it's not a fast dive. She kind of, like, just leans over and reaches and just pulls herself onto it. It's
And she's looking at her reflection. She's seeing, like, her own reflection in there because she doesn't have the wig on. And she pulls herself up, and just the blood covers all the broken glass down below. It's like, this movie's endlessly visually inventive. I do love just. He does kind of show that you don't have to be, it doesn't have to be like a cyberpunk, steampunk world to have this real fantastic composition in these shots and ideas. Because we get like a killer one coming up where she stumbles out into the street holding
wound.
And she's got like the blood streaked down her face from like clutching her, you know, her hand from where she's clutching her belly. And she's gonna get hit by a truck, and she sees it as the spotlight and the roar of the crowd, and just stands,
yeah, like, arms out, ready, just like ready to receive the adulation.
Yeah, no, it's and Mima saves her, and we get maybe what I would argue like maybe one of the only things I don't really care for in this movie. The hospital scene is fine. Because, like,
it's fine.
Rumi's in the hospital, and Mima comes to visit her, and they kind of give, like, a little bit of wrap-up. And this is also a really confusing movie, so I really understand if, like, the audience, I think I probably, the first time I saw this, needed somebody to say, like, no, we know we showed you a bunch of shit, but the shit we just showed you happened. Like, this, that, that's the movie, that's the real thing.
Mm-hmm.
But she's like successful now and like that she's leaving and the nurses can't believe that the successful actress is there. And then we get the ending, like, but I know who I am, and like blazing saxophone solo.
Yeah, the very end is just okay.
He probably got notes from the studio.
No, I'm the real thing.
Make it a little more clear.
Yeah.
It's like George Lucas getting a note saying, you should have some person say, and this is a big Star Wars.
It rhymes. So that's, we walked on through this movie. I'm kind of curious how this one landed for y'all. If there's any more stuff you wanted to talk about. I mean, like the visual inventiveness stuff, like I feel like there's definitely things that we didn't really touch on. Like you were talking about her like floating along. There's like the bit where she's going from like lamppost to lamppost.
Right, exactly.
Like a lot of the transitions are just really cool and interesting where she's like talking to Rumi and like and Sullen, and then like a hand grabs her from behind and it's on the set of the show. There's just sort of no line between time and place.
We talked about how it blurs lines. I think there's a lot of really cool and interesting things that happen with the way that they shot this, for lack of a better word.
Yeah, it's it's also edited. I do want to shout out too, like I think especially in the back half of this movie, the Masahiro Akumi score for this movie. It's mostly like the first bit, you get the songs from Cham and you get like just a little bit of background noise, but then like when the score actually kicks in, it's like a fairly anxiety inducing like,
yeah, that's good. That is something that I wish I picked up more on during first watch throughs. Normally stuff like score, unless it's really really kind of in your face, like a Suspiria or something like that, yeah, I don't pick up on until like third or fourth watch.
Well, if there's nothing else you want to get into specifically, I think we can go into sales country.
No, I think we can head on there. That's fine.
Yeah. This is my, it's hard to say because it's such a broad genre, but this is my favorite anime. I'm also not like an expert, but I've seen like a good chunk. It also just happens to be like that I love giallo movies too, and this lines up with like a lot of the stuff I love about giallo movies, about the priority of sort of placing stylishness and visual inventiveness. A lot of times in some like giallos, that's like at expense of, or maybe prioritized more than story. I think this story mainly holds up. I think it is confusing, but I think if you get,
I feel like it's a pretty simple story too. I mean, there's not a ton to it other than like you have the twist that you have to disguise, but the idea of this person being stalked by a fan and having some issues with her, her identity since she's just made a huge life change is not a crazy one to try to swallow.
Yeah, and it's I really like that idea about because in some sense, like a lot of mysteries, I feel like this is where a lot of mystery writing goes, is it's like ultimately like, oh, if we're so obsessed with discovering like the criminal, like let's discover the self, let's discover the like what's the hidden reality. And I think that's what a lot of like giallo plays with. They play with the kind of grotesqueries to draw you in, but really fundamentally it's about like definition of self and like trust of sense.
Mm-hmm.
How we can operate in the world when these things are not as reliable as we hope them to be. I think it just merges those two worlds. I think it's like, I can't speak to like culturally a lot about like the how it speaks to like the idol scene and stuff too, but I think there's also a lot there about just like kind of the disposability of these folks and sort of this system that's just built to prey on people's
dreams
and ambitions.
That actually reminds me of a scene that we didn't really, we kind of glossed over a little bit earlier. You know, she leaves the group, and the group almost immediately has a hit on the charts. And like they're having the two remaining members are having like a celebratory drink in the other side of the office. And like she's over here, someone saying, you know, you guys are just fine with two.
Yeah.
Like, did she matter at all? Like,
and even they are like they're friendly with her. But when they're on their own, they're making their own private comments about how they view her. Like, you know, oh, if that person's trying to get her clothes out, well, we all know from that rape scene she did, that's not that hard to do. And like getting discovered by Rumi after that, being like embarrassed that they were like shit talking their friend.
I
think it handles that stuff really well. Satoshi Kon has talked about, because a lot of his stuff has female protagonists, about why he likes writing women. And the way he had kind of phrased it was that he likes, that he feels like if he's writing a man, he just writes what he was going to do. And that if when he writes a woman, it's a kind of a step back where he can add some more like objectivity to the story and think about like what he wants to tell. And it just helps him get out of his own head a little bit. I think Mima feels like a, you know, she's in some ways she's a bit of a cipher, because she's doesn't have a lot of agency in her own story, but she does have, she's interesting and compelling, and we're watching her find that agency. Like,
yeah.
But I will turn first to the vote that doesn't count. I Rokian man with a anime movie. Is this a horror movie or is this not a horror movie? Did you like it or not, Jason? We're falling on this one.
Two different questions. I think for me it was not horror, it was suspense. So it was like for me a kind of a more suspenseful version of Fight Club, but one that I had to read.
All right.
I did, you know, I've never seen an anime movie all the way through before, and so I think this was a good one to start with. I enjoyed it. I think if it was 2 hours, maybe I would have enjoyed it less. But I think hour 20 definitely held my attention. I think a lot of it was very inventive, to your point, Josh. Definitely kept my attention the whole time. So I would recommend it to people that do not like horror movies. And I also think it was a good first anime movie, too. So if you're interested in something that's not horror and interested in anime, you could do a lot worse than Perfect Blue.
Let's put it on the box. Let's put it on
the... you could at do least it's not any longer.
The perfect box quote.
All right, Jed, where are you at on this one?
I am with Jason on this one, as I also do not really think that this is horror. Suspense, sure. And I think there is an argument to be made that suspense can be horror. I don't think that this one quite gets there, though. I think for suspense to end up as a horror film for me, the main character has to be in a lot more direct threat than they are in this movie. I mean, at the end, you know, the end notwithstanding, I think that if there had been a progression or an escalation of things that were happening to her, directly, we could have got there, but we didn't get there.
Okay. That said, in the mind.
I liked this movie a lot, like a lot more than I thought I was going to. It is not something that I think I would have chosen to watch just on my own. But there's some stuff in here that I thought was just simply excellent. from like the visuals to the storytelling. I think this movie's great.
Awesome. I'm glad it was a good use of time for the both y'all. I'm glad you enjoyed it. Glad you brought your kids into the room during the photography scene and just.
Yeah. I sent them out for everything else.
So I'm in a weird position with this one. I've got this Crispin Glover Award for Acting Excellence in my hand, and it's an animated movie, and it's in a language I don't speak, so I kind of have a hard time, like, justifying how I can give this to somebody in this movie.
Right, because there's not a performance really that you can judge, at least not one that you can actually understand.
Yeah, I feel like I've fallen into the trap before of like, had the subs versus dubs conversation, but like, oh, I really like listening to this in the original Japanese or this, mm-hmm. or this series or whatever. And I'm like, I really like the sound of their voices. And like, then it gets translated into English. And I'm like, oh, that's so annoying. They picked the most annoying voice for that. And I'm like,
yeah,
people I read or encounter who like actually speak Japanese are like, no, you don't understand. Like the original's really annoying. Like that's, they did a good job because it's supposed to be bad.
Yeah.
So what I have to do for this movie, I think, is get in the Wayback Machine, and I've got a Crispin Glover Award for Acting Excellence here. Instead of giving this to somebody for Perfect Dark, I'm going to go back to the
Perfect
first...
Blue.
yes, perfect. Not the Nintendo 64 shooter follow-up to GoldenEye, to Perfect Blue. I'm going to give it to somebody from one of our first couple movies before the award existed. And I think the oversight correction time has come. I need to give this Crispin Glover Award for Acting Excellence to Crispin Glover for Friday the 13th, Part 4, the final Ooh. Chapter.
Bold.
His Lifetime Achievement Award of the award that bears his name. So
that award didn't originate in that episode?
No, I talked about how much I loved it, but actually the Florence Pugh in Midsommar was the huh. first winner. The birth of that bit. This bit.
Oh yeah, that mean hell. Listeners, go back and check them.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about next time, and as is tradition here, we got a little game we like to play with our guests, where our guests help us pick our next movie. And Jason, I think you might find the pattern here. I'm gonna have you pick a number for me, and here are the numbers that you have to choose from. Are you ready?
Yeah, let's do it.
You pick number 2, number 3, number 4, or number 11.
I think 11. I have to go with 11. I just love the fact that it's just so far out of all the rest.
Okay.
I'm guessing it's going to be Ocean's 11, in which case, yes, I will do that one.
And yes, it is horror.
Utterly, Carl Reiner's performance, utterly terrifying. So, Jason, you were picking a Halloween for us to watch, because we got Halloween times coming up. Mm. So 11 means that you have picked the 11th film in the franchise, Halloween 2018, the reboot that ignores all the other sequels, much like two prior reboots ignored all the... Halloween's real confusing, man. We're going to do the Halloween that's Halloween, but not the first Halloween, but not also not the second Halloween. Does that make more sense?
No, yeah. Perfect.
Okay. Halloween 1, Part 3. Got it. That's yeah. the one.
First Blood, Part 2, Halloween 1, Part 3. Makes sense.
Before we get into business side, is there any stuff y'all want to shout out, you want to give some props to? Other than where you would book a wonderful Disney vacation, where was that again?
Yeah, everyone already knows about magicbymandy.com. It's available both on desktop computer and mobile.
Oh, sweet.
Ooh. Yeah.
What about Kindle?
It was designed for Kindle.
Okay, good. So, Jed, you got anything you want to shout out?
Hey, you know what? I don't have anything specific that I'm going into right now. I was watching She-Hulk.
Yeah.
Surprisingly good.
Okay. Good. I think we talked, you'd mentioned it before, and that was part of your many things Marvel makes are mediocre and I watch them. That's my recommendation.
No, I think I've watched enough of it to firmly come down on the side of this one's a good one.
Got it. Cool. Yeah, I will eventually check that out. Maybe it has Daredevil in it, which I...
Yeah, he was in the last episode that I watched.
Awesome. Let's get up onto the business side here. You can please reach out to us, our Facebook group, at Selling the Scream. Just ask for an invite. We'll let you in after you answer some robot questions. Send us an email at sellingthescream@gmail.com. We are on Twitter at ScreamSelling. If you could please leave us a review on the podcatcher of your choice, it helps us get noticed a little bit more. If I am checking the iOS update here.
God, these guys.
Every time, man. It says that if you don't like this Selling the Scream, that you can see the real Selling the Scream if you go to Jed's room and leave a review there.
It's true.
Yep. So until next time when we do Halloween 11, bye-bye.
Yeah, Jason, thanks for being here, and bye-bye.
Bye, everyone.
Oh, thank you.